the errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University. Now, here's your host, Ward Morrow.
This is Jason Fornicola filling in for Ward Morrow. Today, we'll be joined by AFL-CIO Executive Vice President Arlene Holt-Baker. But first, hear Ward's interviews with WUSA 9 reporter and weekend anchor Bruce Johnson and AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon.
We've been joined by Bruce Johnson, reporter and anchor of Channel 9 WUSA-TV and author of Heart to Heart, 12 People Discover Better Lives After Their Heart Attacks. So tell us a little about this book. Why did you write it?
Well, the book wasn't my idea, to be honest. I was writing another book about news reporting and some of my experiences as a reporter. But I'd had a heart attack in July of 92 and had recovered, was back at work, back with my family, that sort of thing, leading the life, if you will. And a friend of mine lost her husband to a heart attack. And so we were having dinner. She says to me, I know you've got some other writing assignments, some other ideas, but this is the book you need to write first, Heart to Heart, because there are a lot of people. As a matter of fact, it's the leading cause of death in this country, who are going to have heart attacks, and they're not going to be as lucky as you. My husband wasn't, so you need to write this book. And so I did. Being a reporter, I didn't want to just write my story, and to be quite honest, it was kind of ambivalent about writing my story. You know how reporters are. We want to write about everybody else. I don't want you looking at me, none of this man in the mirror stuff. But I got 11 other people, men, women, black, white, different socioeconomic status. And I convinced them to help me write this book. And I convinced them, like this woman convinced me, that this is a public service. We need to do this for all the other people out there, not just those that have had heart attacks, but those who will have heart attacks and those who just want to be heart healthy. And so that's when we started on this project.
Well, since you're the one being interviewed today, I'm going to ask you about you. And tell us a little about the events that surrounded your heart attack and the day it happened. What were you feeling? What was going through your mind?
Okay. July 2nd, 1992. I'm in Southeast Washington, large public housing project, and I'm covering a story. And to make it short, I'm in the middle of interviewing some young guys who are standing on the corner selling drugs. And they had just pulled up their shirts, and they're showing me their the battle scars, you know, namely bullet wounds. And I've got that story, and I've woven that into the Mayor's Summer Jobs Program and why these guys are not applying for the Mayor's Summer Jobs Program. So I'm on my way back to the station, and I feel this tightness in my chest. I wasn't worried in the beginning because I was an exercise buff. You know, I consider myself in good shape, but that was my assessment, obviously, not some doctors or somebody who would know better. This tightness in the chest continued, and for some reason, I said, this is not the norm. You know, I was the kind of guy that would have a hamburger for lunch. I may have had a hamburger that day, a steak, you know, that night for dinner. I just didn't think a lot about heart attacks and that something like this could happen to me, maybe to you or somebody else, but not to me. My photographer, God bless him, Mike Fox, realized there was something wrong with me. He later said that I was irritable and sprinkled in a couple of profanities that are in the book that I won't repeat here. He decided to drive to a firehouse, and he rolled the car up to this firehouse in Southeast D.C. He got out, he ran inside, and he says, "Hey, I got a newsman, you know, Bruce Johnson out here. Something's wrong with him." The paramedics came out, they took one look at me, slapped me on the gurney, put me in the back of the ambulance and drove me to the nearest hospital, Greater Southeast. And, you know, once I got into the emergency room, a lot of staff, a lot of buzz. I was fortunate that the head of cardiology came in. And I said to him, "You can tell me," you know, his name was Dr. Joseph Robinson, who's still my doctor today. "I can take it. You can tell me what's wrong." And he says, "Well, I think this was after the second EKG. I can tell you this. You've had a massive heart attack." That was the headline. That was the lead. I mean, it was a blow. I was totally in shock.
And you were mentioning earlier before we started the interview about what it was like. You said you kind of felt like you were giving over at that point, that you know, you were kind of bottoming out because you're laying on a gurney. I mean, you go from being a reporter where you're kind of, you know, you're picking your stories, you're in charge, you're talking, you're wheeling and dealing, and now all of a sudden you're just sort of laying on a gurney in a hospital. What was that experience like?
Well, you know, I write in the book that it was kind of like an out-of-body experience. And I don't know if it was due to the drugs. They give you nitroglycerin, you know, as you're on your way to the hospital. And if not, then certainly once you get into the emergency room to kind of clear, you know, the blockage. TPB is the clot buster that I think it was also given. So, you're never sure if it's the drugs or if you're really there. But I write about it, you know, as though I was there. And I felt as though this could be the end, you know. And keep it in mind, I had no idea what the end was supposed to look like. You know, I was raised Catholic, and I fell back on that. You know, let's see if this is the end. I'm going to end up either in heaven or that other place. And I surrendered right then and there. I said to myself, you know, I've done all that I can to get here, and probably did some things to contribute to my being here, you know, eating habits or whatever, but this could be it. So there was nothing I could do to save me. And so I immediately, I don't know if it's so much immediately, but I eventually surrendered to this doctor, Joseph Robinson, who had a great bedside manner, and to the rest of the staff there. If I'm going to get out of here, if I'm going to make it through this, it's going to be because of their work and God's work. Certainly nothing that I can do from this point on. They stabilized me at Greater Southeast Community Hospital and eventually flew me to the Washington Hospital Center, where they performed emergency angioplasty. And you know, they had a team of doctors there, I learned later. I mean, they were going to do whatever they needed to do, crack the chest open, bypass, whatever he needed. It was like, well, we're going to do whatever we can to save this guy. So I got absolutely the best medical care, and it was angioplasty. And I was never totally unconscious during this thing. I'm watching the screen. Hector Collinson and Joseph Robinson, graduates of Howard University Med School, they identified the clock, you know, that artery, and they cleared it, you know, with a balloon. Went in, opened it up, angioplasty, opened it up, and you know, I remember them saying, "Well, how do you feel now?" And you know, I'm thinking, "Well, the correct answer is I feel fine." So I said, "I'm feeling fine." I didn't know how I was feeling. You know what I mean? And so they were very much concerned about heart failure after that, because I had taken a hit. I mean, you could see on the echogram, you know, days after that, that the bottom part of the heart muscle just wasn't moving, responding. You know, if you think of the fist opening, closing, that's how the heart's supposed to operate. Well, the top part of my heart was doing all the work. Bottom part wasn't moving. It was just it was just in shock. It was stunned. And they had no way of knowing at that time if it was ever going to move again, which meant, as one cardiologist said when he came in and looked at my chart, well, I've seen charts like that where half the people survived and half didn't. And he was responding to my question, how's it look? I wish I hadn't asked the question after that. But I exercised, did the rehab. Washington Hospital Center had a great rehab program, and obviously responded well to it.
And what kind of things do you do in the rehab program?
In the rehab program, they start you off very slowly. They have a rowing machine. There's a treadmill. Might have been some light weights. They also have that, what I call the panic button there, you know, because they're like, well, if he doesn't make it, we'll hit this button, you know, and we'll get the emergency team back in here. So that's in the back of your mind also. I mean, they're treating me very gingerly. And I approached rehab kind of reluctantly, because there was nobody else in there that looked like me, that looked fit, that looked fairly young. And I write about a guy in the book, 33-year-old Evan Kushner, who was still is a very prominent attorney in Boston, who had a heart attack also, and he walked out of a rehab because nobody looked like him, and kind of went at it alone. But I stayed because I didn't want anybody to say I was a quitter, and I kind of felt they're looking at me, and if I can encourage them, fine. You know, we're all in this together. And as one of the head nurses said to me, the power is in, you know, one heart attack survivor telling and showing his story to somebody else. And so that kind of stuck with me. So we did light treadmill work. We did weights, did the rowing machine. And eventually when I got out of, you know, the hospital, went home, I do the outpatient rehab thing, and then started working out on my own. I was convinced I'm going to do more than this. I want to do more than just survive a heart attack. I want to live. I want to thrive.
Now, in the book, you go through 12 different people, and very different people in many ways. How did you come about those 12 people? And let's talk a little about who some of them were.
Every way imaginable. My doctor came up with a couple of his patients, you know, one being a minister, Reverend James Love. He was preaching at a mega church in Bowie, Maryland, and had a heart attack right in the pulpit. And, you know, nobody there recognized it as a heart attack. They thought he'd been overcome by the Holy Spirit. You know, Reverend Love and his wife, after he recovered, then decided that his entire church would go on a heart healthy diet. They stopped eating the fried chicken mashed potatoes, the sweet tea and the cakes and pies that we all know, you know, come with the church, especially the Southern Baptist, you know, religion, as we know. And he eventually got his entire church on a heart healthy diet. You know, he no longer called the choir the mass choir. They were losing weight so quickly. So I was really intrigued by his story. Evan Kushner again, the young guy from Boston. I found him on Facebook. I appealed to my Facebook friends. Anybody know anybody who's survived a heart attack? I'm especially looking for young people. And a friend of mine on Facebook, a friend that I've never even met, she says, I think I know somebody. Let me check. And next thing you know, I'm hearing from Evan Kushner in Boston. And we connected. And Evan got on a plane and ended up here in D.C. And we had lunch in Georgetown, a lunch that probably should have gone maybe an hour or two. And it went twice that long. And then we met the following day at the station. And we instantly became a support group for one another because he had never, ever told his story to anybody. Couldn't talk to his parents, couldn't talk to his friends. His friends didn't want to hear about it. I mean, because you know, that kind of guilt by association. Well, if he's had a heart attack, what does that say about me? Couldn't talk to his parents because there's no history of cardiovascular disease in his family. Erin Pfeiffer, outside of Baltimore, a young woman, 39 years old when she had her cardiovascular event, calls it the best thing that ever happened to her. And a lot of people, if you haven't been there, you won't understand this because it nearly cost her marriage. She lost her job. She lost her health insurance, nearly lost her home. She's on total disability now, but it caused her to reassess everything in life. Like a lot of us, she had been chasing the almighty dollar, you know, wanted to be totally unlike her mother, stay-at-home mom, you know, supporting the family and that sort of thing. And she now is a staunch advocate for women. There's another woman, Mary, out of Wheeling, West Virginia. She was a stay-at-home mom, had done everything for her family, didn't even bother to get a driver's license until... one day, when she had gone back to school, she was having chest pains and she calls her husband to come get her and, she couldn't find him. So she walks home in cardiac arrest about 3 miles. When she gets home and he finally gets there and she says, I'm having these chest pains. And keep in mind, it's only recently that we've come to realize that women have heart attacks. You know, before we thought this was just a disease of older men. And, her husband says to her once he gets home, let's sleep on it. And if you still feel badly in the morning, I'll take you to the hospital. So she's up all night, you know, in severe pain, nearly died. The next morning, he says, let me take a shower. Then I'll take you to the hospital. She goes to the hospital. Needless to say, she ended up having an emergency bypass. Again, today, an advocate, you know, for women and really trying to get that message out there to women that this is the leading cause of death. For women, cardiovascular disease. It's not breast cancer. It's not all these other things. It's cardiovascular disease. Same as men.
As we come into our last minute, let me ask you, as you look forward, things that are that people need to focus on. I mean, I know my grandmother had a similar kind of situation, went to the Washington Hospital Center. They gave her nitroglycerin, and it's like when she took her medicine, she was amazing. You were mentioning earlier about medical care. Do you think that's the most important factor that people need to get to a doctor, get tested?
Yeah, definitely. And my thing, even if you don't buy the book, if you go to brucejohnsonhearttoheart.com, we've got a lot of very good information, you know, for men and women about cardiovascular disease and heart attacks. We get a lot of hits on this website. It's important to us. Not only do you have to get to a doctor who's going to do the right physical, not just put the stethoscope on the chest, you know, and have you stick your tongue out. You want somebody who's going to do a complete physical. I think even before that, though, we have to convince ourselves that we're going to become our own best advocates. A lot of times, you know, we're not eating properly. We're doing no exercise. And so you're high risk, whether you know it or not. Don't just look at the fact my parents never had a heart attack. Look at yourself. Look at your waist size. Start doing the things you can to control your own destiny. Become your own best advocate. In the past, you know, we'd go to the doctor once we became incredibly ill and we'd say to the doctor, fix me. We no longer have to take that attitude. Let's start fixing ourselves first. Let's help the doctors help us. That's what they're asking for.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Bruce Johnson, reporter and anchor for Channel 9, WUSA-TV, and author of Heart to Heart, 12 People Discover Better Lives After Their Heart Attacks. So as we're ending that last segment, we're talking about getting good medical care, and you mentioned the Washington Hospital Center, and D.C. has a lot of hospitals that are really prominent in this field. What are some of the other things in terms of diet and lifestyle changes that you went through?
Well, lifestyle changes. I had a nutritionist after my heart attack, and that's when I came to realize just how dumb I'd been when it came to what I was eating. I don't eat red meat now, and don't miss it at all. And I'm not one of these strict constructionists when it comes to diets. I mean, I like sweets. I mean, and that's my kryptonite. And but I try to do it in moderation. I'll never forget when I was going through my recovery, and I was at this picnic, and then there were barbecued ribs there. And I mean, you know, I have a birthright to this kind of food. And so I'm sitting there suffering, not able to eat these ribs. And I get back to the hospital, and the nutritionist says to me, Bruce, you could have had some of the ribs. You know, what I'm just asking you to do is no longer eat the whole slab of ribs. You know, sample, be smart about it. You know, the other thing I did, you know, following my heart attack during my recovery is I decided to become a runner. And I had despised running before, but I feel like Forrest Gump, you know, now, because I started running a little bit in rehab, and then I would double that. And I convinced my doctor, and he's looking at the echogram the whole time, and he's seen that that heart muscle was starting to come back alive, even though the scar tissue was still there. And we agreed one day, you know, and it was a few years after my heart attack, that heart, as he's pointing to the echogram, talking about me, that heart can run and finish a marathon as long as you're not trying to win the marathon. Well, that was all I needed. And so I continued training, and I did run and finish the Marine Corps marathon, finishing in front of, you know, half the men my age, and continued running after that. So it was part of my therapy, and it convinced me that I'm okay, that I'm alive, you know, that I can get back out there. I can go back to being a full-time journalist, that I can get back to enjoying life, my family, my kids, and that sort of thing. And that's what everybody in this book, for the most part, says, that their heart attack was the beginning and not the end of anything. You know, we were going to continue to live, and we were going to live smarter. We were going to exercise. We were going to watch our diet. We were not going to have as much stress. Let somebody else have the stress. We would learn to forgive ourselves, give ourselves a break, and give others a break. You know, the guy who cuts me off on the beltway, that's fine. You go right ahead of doing 75. I'm going to do 65, you know, because that just works for me. And you have reason to reassess, you know, when you're lying there on your back, you know, and on the gurney, or, you know, in the hospital. How is the rest of my life going to be like? You know, should I survive this? Should I get out of this? So, and you try to do it a day at a time. And I know that's cliche, that's used and used, it's overused, but a day at a time, you know, just take it easy. There really aren't that many big deals in life, you know. And before, I was totally the opposite. Type A, everything was a big deal, had to win, everything was a competition, and I was going to come out first, and you were going to come out in second.
Let's focus on that for a minute, because, you know, in the type of job that you have, and as most of the listeners know, I was a Baltimore City drug prosecutor for many years, so the stress level was pretty high in what I was doing. And I mean, you've got to be on the air, you've got to be on top of your game, you can't sort of be real relaxed and, you know, taking your time. I mean, you've got deadlines, you've got, you know, limited amount of space and time to do things. How are you able to manage your stress in what is clearly a very high stress environment?
You know, number one, I thrive on the competition. So, and I think that's okay. You know, athletes, you know, and that's stress, you know, but I thrive on that. But one of the things I've convinced myself on most days, now, you know, we don't have to be perfect at this. I mean, it's a process, you know, and it's a journey. One of the things I've convinced myself is, number one, somebody else can do this job. You know what I mean? And somebody else will do this job if and when, you know, I'm out of this job, whether it's because I take myself out or somebody else takes me out of this job. So it's not that important what I do, you know, in the scheme of things. What is important is that I do it to the best of my ability, that I give 100, 110%, and then know when I'm given 100, 110%, and let that be it. You know, I don't stress over somebody else grading me. I don't stress over what do they think of the job I did. You know, I don't worry about the self-esteem. I think a lot of this comes with age also. When we're younger, you know, I mean, come on, we're panicked. You know, it's never good enough. You know, we're always concerned about that grade. You don't worry about that as much, I think, as you get older. And you certainly don't worry about it as much once you have looked death in the face and you survive. And you realize you survive not because of anything you've done. It's because somebody has given you another chance. You know, and then if you're like me and you believe in a higher power, you're grateful for every day. And you realize now what's important is, what can I do with what I've got left? You know, for somebody else, for the most part, you know, it's not just about me. And it's like this book, I think, you know, we all agree, those of us who contributed to this book, it's bigger than us. And we agree to tell our stories and some embarrassing things in this book, some things I probably wouldn't tell you if we were just having dinner. But I want you to know that I'm just like you, and I'm telling you my story in hopes that it'll benefit you in some way. And it's all here in the book. And I convinced the other people that have contributed to this book, tell me some things that make you uncomfortable, that you really don't want people to know, but might move other people to realize that we're human. We've had successes, we've had failures, and here's how we dealt with it before and after the heart attack. Because I think who we are and everything we're about, we bring into these experiences, these life and death experiences.
And I'm thinking particularly for people that are in a high stress environment, you go through something like this, and maybe your employer's pretty good about being supportive while you're in rehab and that sort of thing. But at some point, you got to get back to where you were. And you mentioned, I guess it was Aaron Pfeiffer, people who, you know, in a situation where you could lose your job, you could lose your house, and you may not be able to go back to what you were once doing. That's an additional stress and scary situation for somebody, in addition to the health problem you're dealing with.
You know, one of the things I learned, and I didn't know until I had my heart attack, why would I? There are support groups out here for this sort of thing. People that have been there. This book is nothing but an extension of the support groups that are out there. The biggest and the one that I'm most proud of that I joined, and I don't recommend that everybody do the things I did to qualify, but namely have a heart attack, Mended Hearts. It's the support group of the American Heart Association. It's a national body. I was one of the keynote speakers at their convention outside of Minneapolis this year. It's a group of people that have survived heart attacks and serious cardiovascular events, and it's the power of one of us telling our stories to others, and that's the power in this book. You know, all of your questions, all of your fears, your concerns have been addressed. There is nothing unique about you or me or those of us who have heart attacks or serious cardiovascular bouts, or who are trying to start a heart healthy or a fitness program. Nothing unique about you. It's done every day, many, many times a day. And if you're lucky enough to survive a heart attack or not to have one, you can still use, you know, these organizations, this book, because that's what we're here for. It's giving back. We're trying to save lives. I mean, let's just lay it out there. We're trying to save lives. You don't want to have to go through what I went through to be here to do this interview.
And, you know, for people that are reluctant, and there's a lot of us that are, about going to the doctor, and, you know, you get to, you know, men of a certain age, as they say, you know, women of a certain age as well, you're going to be put on a bunch of medications in all likelihood, you know, statins, things like that. And you keep seeing on television the downsides, you know, that muscle pain, liver damage, you know, I mean, they start throwing all the things out. Do you think that in some ways there's a barrier to people going in getting health care on this stuff because of some of that?
I take a statin every day. Okay, my cholesterol level was incredibly elevated at the time of my heart attack. So, I mean, come on, that was a direct cause. So I take a statin every day. I take a baby aspirin every day. Don't smoke, don't drink, exercise 3-4 times a week. I have a very, very good life. I don't see the downside. You got to get over the fear. I mean, help yourself, become your own advocate. My thing is, look around you. A young friend of mine at Channel 7 here in Washington, Jennifer Donlan, just had a heart attack, 35 years old. I went to visit her in the hospital. I don't need any more motivation than that, you know, to stay on this program that I'm on. And I don't know how I can impress upon people any more than that. There was a 17-year-old high school football star, you know, scored a touchdown, then has a heart attack. I had another friend who is a businessman out here in D.C., about 50 years of age, who is now on a statin, had a stent put in, had a heart attack, you know, less than 2 weeks ago. That's all the proof I need. The people that I meet are enjoying life more so than they did when they were out here overweight, eating whatever they wanted, stressing about stuff, living inside their own heads. There's a better life. And if you can get to it before you have that heart attack, you're all the better for it, because there's no guarantee you're going to survive that heart attack. You know, there's no guarantee. Why wait for the heart attack to come looking for you? You know, start doing something now. And you can find, I don't care how rich you are, how poor you are, there are things you can do right now that don't cost money. I don't belong to a gym, because I can't stand to be inside. I work out outside. Doesn't cost me anything. My favorite pastime is running, on the beach in the Atlantic Ocean, you know, Rehoboth, Dewey, Lewis, Delaware. Doesn't cost me anything. I just got to get there. You know, I have a bike, a Cannondale Super 6 that I love. It doesn't cost me anything to hit Rock Creek Park and get on that bike and just go, you know, for 25, 30 miles. Most of what we can do to make ourselves better, doesn't cost anything.
And as we talk about that, though, I mean, one of the big contributors is diet, obviously. And you said, you know, you made some lifestyle changes around that. Do you think here in the D.C. area that that's one of the things that could be addressed, particularly I'm thinking with the business community? I mean, when you got to go to lunch and you're on the go, and let's face it, everybody in Washington is on the go, whether you're, you know, a federal employee, which is most of our listeners, or even the private sector, you only got a limited amount of time for lunch. You need to grab and go. And obviously people can grab and go salads and put no dressing on it. But I mean, you know, when you get down to what people want, do you think that maybe restaurants need to change what they're doing to make things healthier for people?
Well, we've all got choices, and you can eat healthy, I think, with what's out there now. I'll take it further. And I've had this conversation with the mayor. You know, the mayor's a triathlete. You know, why can't the mayor become a poster child for the whole D.C. government? You know, 40,000 employees. Extend the lunch hour. Give them cash bonuses for losing weight, getting healthy. Get them discounts in health clubs here in the city. The federal government can do the same thing. You know, a lot of this is socioeconomic also. You know, those at the higher end who have the education, they know this. It's at the lower end. What are you going to do? School cafeterias, for example, one of our council members, Mary Che, has come up with legislation, had to pass a law to get the junk food out of the school cafeterias and get healthy stuff in there. We need to take that further. How are you going to get low-income people? And that's where the obesity levels and numbers are really high. How do you get them out exercising, especially in these dangerous communities where, you know, when they get off work, it's dark, it's night. Who's going to protect them? Who's going to protect their few valuables? When they're out exercising, who's going to watch their apartments? Well, why can't police do roll calls, you know, outside? Why I do it locked up, hidden away in the police station? There are a lot of things we can do if we just decide we're going to do it. The mall, for the most part, at lunchtime is still fairly empty. We got all these government offices and employees downtown. Why aren't they all out on the mall? Why can't we make the lunch hour instead of an hour? Let's make it 2 hours, okay? And then give bonuses, give people incentives for being out there. You know what I hear from women? I speak to a lot of government agencies now about exercising. The biggest concern for the women, what about my hair? I don't want to sweat my hair out. Well, and I say to the women, but you got to sweat. You got to get the heart rate up to the point where you got some benefit. So that's something that has to be addressed. I don't know what goes on in the women's locker rooms, if they have blow dryers and that sort of thing and showers. But let's address that, you know, so they can be more healthy. Give them what they ask them, first of all, what they need. And then the same with others, the handicapped individuals, you know, that work for the government. What do you need to get out, you know, to exercise? Help people, organize groups. You know, get the health experts into the agencies to lead these walks at lunchtime or immediately after work or before work. I mean, I think there's a lot we could do. You know, I don't think it costs a lot of money. I don't think it takes an act of Congress to get us started on this either.
You're listening to AFG's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Jackie Simon, AFG's Public Policy Director. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a little about the Office of Personnel Management's recently released the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, and premiums are going to be increasing by 7.2% in 2011. Is that right?
Well, every year when OPM announces the beginning of open season in the fall, they also at the same time publish the new premiums for the plans that participate in FEHBP. And so the headline is always the gross average, which doesn't really tell you very much about the range of premium increases that that there are within the program. You know, almost 30% of enrollees are going to have premium increases that are, you know, in 10% or above. Some are even more than 50%.
Some people are going to have a 50% premium increase?
Some of the plans have a 50% premium increase, yep. That happens every year. The most popular plan, however, the one that has the largest number of enrollees, is the Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option. Every year, that's somewhere around 60% of all enrollees are in that one. And for that one this year, the enrollee share, the employee share, will be going up by 6.9% for those with self-only coverage and 7.6% for those with family coverage.
And how does this compare to previous years?
Well, if you're really looking for a silver lining and something positive to say, which, you know, takes some looking when it comes to FEHBP, we can say this. For the last 12 years, every year, the enrollees' share of premiums has gone up by more than the government's share, a higher percentage increase. That's been, you know, it's been a story of cost shifting, gradual cost shifting over the decade. And, you know, 12 years ago, it was about 72% the government's share, and now it's down to 67%. So if you're looking for good news, as a comparison with previous years, you can say that this year, for the first time in a long, long time, there wasn't any additional cost shifting in Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option. Last year, the government paid 67% of the increase. This year, the government's paying 67% of the increase. And, you know, if you just do the arithmetic, then you know that this year, for the first time, the enrollee share didn't go up by any more than the government's share.
But when you compare that, as we look to what the impact will really be on federal employees with whatever the pay raise is going to be, does it essentially become a wash?
Well, we don't know the size of the pay raise yet. So, of course, it would only be a wash for some people, depending on you know, what your salary is. You know, no matter what your salary is, you pay the same premiums. They don't charge more for a GS-15 than they do for a GS-1. But you know, the enrollee contributions are going to go up by about $300 a year for family coverage on average. And you know, there's still the average family premium is for an enrollee is around $4,500 a year. You know, that's a big bite out of anybody's salary. Obviously a much bigger bite out of the lower graded employee salary than the higher graded employee salary.
And do we know anything about the copays? Are copays going to be going up at all, particularly I'm thinking the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan?
No, that happened a few years ago. They changed the formula or changed the terms of enrollee copays for out-of-network and increased those dramatically. I mean, after we raised a lot of we were very, very strongly opposed to that, and we got the Congress to intervene and limit the amount of the increase of employee copays for out-of-network treatment in Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option. They didn't go back to what it had been before. That was maybe 3 years ago. What I wanted to tell you, Ward, that, you know, it just sort of explains why FEHBP is so expensive and why we're such harsh critics of the program. And this has to do with, you know, what's going to happen next year, why these year-to-year costs are so outrageous and why some plans go up as much as 50%. This year, OPM, you know, puts out, like it does every year, puts out a call letter to the insurance companies telling them what they want to see in the coming year. So this year they put out, you know, this language, and they're always very, very sweet to their insurance companies. And they said that they'd like to see, not what we are requiring, but we'd like to see more benefits on testing donors for bone marrow or stem cell transplants. You know, these are rare situations for any enrollee, but when it occurs, when you are sick enough to need a bone marrow transplant or a stem cell transplant, you really need it. And so OPM was encouraging ever so gently the insurance companies to offer those kinds of benefits. Well, 16 plans have offered coverage for the testing of up to 4 transplant donors. So what's going to happen? Well, if you happen to be somebody who's going to need that kind of treatment, if you've got an illness that that kind of treatment is, you know, one of the possibilities in the course of your care, well, of course you're going to switch out of whatever plan you're in, and you're going to go into the plan that has this transplant donor coverage. And then what's going to happen to prices in those particular plans? They're going to go through the roof because all the sickest people are going to congregate in those plans. This is a long way of saying the FEHBP is a structurally flawed program, and it's why it's so expensive, because instead of having a standard benefits package and making all the different plans offer the same package and then compete on quality, they let them vary dramatically. And so people who are very, very sick congregate in one plan, and that one gets ridiculously expensive. And then it drives out all the, you know, healthier, lower risk people out of that plan into another plan, and you've got all kinds of skews in this, in these prices. And instead of putting everybody in the same boat and then being able to negotiate for the best prices for everybody.
Well, let's also talk about the Affordable Care Act. Tell us a little about that. How does that affect federal workers and AFG members?
Well, the Affordable Care Act, which is the name of the act that we sometimes refer to as National Health Care Reform, its provisions are being adopted, gradually over the course of the next few years. And this year, there are two things that are, required by the law that FEHBP has adopted. And one is a really, popular one and well-known one, and that is offering coverage for dependents up to age 26. And they don't have to be full-time students. So everyone has been, everyone with an uninsured 23-year-old or 24-year-old has been very much looking forward to being able to have this. And you have to have family coverage for eligibility on this. And so, that's something from the Affordable Care Act that's certainly a positive. And the other new provision that is going to show up in FEHBP is that there'll be no more co-pays for preventive care and annual screenings. So those are two big positives. There's one other thing that's not the Affordable Care Act, but they are also requiring this year all the plans to provide coverage for smoking cessation. And this includes, medications and counseling sessions, up to 2 quit attempts per year, and all the plans will have that, and there will be no copays.
So for some folks, particularly people with children, say, under the age of 27, there may be some advantages to this new plan, obviously.
Oh, for coverage up to 26?
Yeah.
Oh, no question about it. It's extremely valuable and popular, and it's one of the most the most popular parts of the Affordable Care Act, and it went into effect September 23rd, but it couldn't go into effect for FEHBP because they gave plans an opportunity to wait to implement it until a new contract year following September 23rd. So January 1st, that's the date of coverage.
Are there any other things that AFG's been pushing, particularly in seeking to get in there that we've gotten?
That we have gotten?
Yeah.
No. I wish I were able to tell you that OPM had listened to our very persuasive arguments. We have been trying for years now, really getting close to 10 years, to get FEHBP to cover one particular treatment for autism. It's called applied behavioral analysis, and it's been found to be the most effective treatment for severely autistic children, and needs to occur early in their lives to have its maximum impact. And, once upon a time it was cutting edge, it was experimental, but that's no longer the case. It's certainly many, many large private employers cover it. And FEHBP, has been a late adopter, and that's an optimistic way of saying it. They have failed yet again to ask the insurance carriers to cover that. So we'll keep up that fight. It's not the kind of thing that's in any way frivolous. When you need this, you need this, and it's a glaring problem with coverage in FEHBP.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFG's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Research shows continuing your education is the best way to increase your earning potential. Grantham University can give you the education you've always wanted. With their exclusive partnership with AFGE, you'll receive discounted tuition available to AFGE members and their families. Grantham's degree programs are 100% online to fit your busy schedule. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Arlene Holt Baker, the Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Jason.
Now, the AFL and many unions and organizations around the country have recently participated in what was the One Nation March at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Tell us a little bit about the march and what the purpose was.
Well, Jason, tens of thousands of people from, quite frankly, around the nation came to the Lincoln Memorial on October the 2nd to talk about issues that are so important to everyone in our nation. Jobs, because there is a need for job creation. We know this with 15 million workers unemployed, and need for boldness in a legislative agenda that can put America back to work and put America back to work with good jobs for the long term. People also gathered to talk about the issues of justice, certainly for those who were there talking about workers and justice. People and workers talked about workers needing to have the ability to organize, therefore saying that they needed legislation and labor law reform that would give them the right to organize in a collective manner if they chose to do so. Transportation security officers were there, as you very well know, with AFGE organizing those workers. They were there to talk about the need to work collectively and to have a union so that they could have a voice at work, so that they could ensure that they had input in making sure that those who travel in our country are secure. And then we had those who gathered, from students to teachers and others who are concerned about education in this country, with a focus on the need to ensure that every child in our country has access to quality public education, Jason. But people left with a determination that this upcoming election is so very, very critical. And if we are able to go forward in this country, it's going to be dependent on activism from those who came. So they left charged up and ready to vote on November the 2nd and to keep on fighting on November the 3rd to move the country forward so that we can ensure that we have elected our officials who are going to be bold in their policies to put us back to work. We will have elected officials who will be bold in protecting the rights of not just workers, but in fact, the human rights of all people in this country, no matter their sexual orientation, their race, or gender. And then certainly education, the boldness there that we need is to ensure that there are resources to continue to have a quality public education system.
Talk for a minute, if you can, about the sacrifice that people make here at home for things like justice, education, public education, workers' rights, those sorts of things.
Well, when you think about education, so many people make major sacrifices to make sure that their children can go to school, continue on from K through 12, and to college. And they are so dependent, especially now, on having jobs that can at least support that. We hear from so many of our own members, as well as our community allies, that people are very concerned that their children will not have the same kind of life that they currently have, though it's they're struggling, their children won't have it as good as they have it, because they see children returning back home. They're not able to pay for education because of this economic crisis that we're in. So the issue of education for so many parents and young people is critical. It certainly needs to be affordable. But one of the things that you look at, and when you say an election can make a difference, we've got to make sure that we have elected officials who are supportive of legislation, such as this administration was and this Congress was, in pushing forth Pell Grants for students. So under good administrations who really put their money behind educational policies to ensure that every child in this country who wants to have an education should have access to it, K through 12 and beyond, it's important that you're voting for those people who support those kinds of values.
And talk about the teachers for a minute. Everyone knows that without the teachers, the educational process simply won't happen. We need good quality teachers in the classroom. And if you can, tell us a little bit about how important it is to recruit and retain the best teachers.
Well, absolutely. You hit it, Jason, when you said good quality teachers. First of all, let me say that there are certainly tremendously, overwhelmingly, the majority of our teachers are good teachers. There is no doubt about that. We all often say it comes to our own minds when we think about our education, and especially through the K through 12 education, the teacher that helped us along the way. But teachers cannot do it alone. It takes a village, and you must have administrators, parents, teachers, and the broader community invested here. When we talk about the training of teachers, you've got to make sure that there are resources available for those who are in the system to be able to continue to be trained so that they kind of have the skills to keep up what's happening in society and be able to have knowledge of the curriculum that is always sometimes changing because our society is changing. But one of the ways in which you can certainly ensure that we can attract more quality educators, if you will, is we've got to make sure that teachers are paid properly. Here it is, teachers are charged with educating our society, but yet many of them are not compensated adequately for what they do. I'd love to see them make the salaries of CEOs, quite frankly, but that's they may not get to that level. But one thing we know, that without teachers, again, having the ability to bargain collectively for good wages and working conditions, there would be no hope of their wages increasing. So teachers, certainly, we need to find a way to pay our teachers their worth, and that would certainly bring more people into the education system because many young people graduating from college would love to be teachers. But quite frankly, even if they come into the system for a few years, they often find that they cannot support their families on those wages, and then they may look to get out of the system. So increasing pay is vitally important. Making sure that there are adequate training programs there is important. And making sure, again, that we are not seeing so many of our children, you know, classroom size. We've got to have a reduction in the classroom sizes so the teachers can do what they're meant to do and give the kind of attention that they need to the students. But we all know that our classroom sizes are growing as opposed to decreasing.
And education has been at the forefront recently. You see it in the headlines and on the television and the radio. Everyone's talking about it. Do you think that we're on the cusp of a major education reform in this country to really get us where we need to be?
Well, I think there certainly is an awful lot of attention on education currently. In many ways, I think this is a unique opportunity. Our teachers' unions have made it very clear that they are willing to come to the table to find a solution because they want it to work too. They're invested in this. But I must say that there is great concern by many of us in terms of what's happening now, the bashing publicly of teachers and their unions. Again, teachers' unions are there to ensure that there is due process for those workers. So you never back away from that. But you certainly have heard President from the teachers' union, Randy Weingarten, say this is a time because the one thing that is clear, that teachers care about the future of this country and that they know that the future of this country is only going to be brighter if we have more educated students. So they are focused on educating the students, but they also need some tools here.
Let's shift gears for just a minute and talk about job creation in America. Where do you think we are with that? Have we made enough progress? Are we doing the things that we need to do in order to really get people back to work and get the economy really going again?
Well, we certainly have made some progress. We must give credit to the Obama administration, because the stimulus package, if we had not had it after he came into office, if we had not had that, we would not have been able to see at least 3 million jobs either created or saved. So that was absolutely necessary. But there is much more that we need to do. We need to put America back to work. One of the ways that we certainly believe that we could start to do that is we've got to invest in our infrastructure. We have a crumbling infrastructure. All of us know it. Our bridges are crumbling. Our roads are in need of great repair. We would have an opportunity, if we chose to do it, to invest in transportation and high-speed rail with good jobs, good-paying jobs, but also jobs that could be green jobs because of our concern for the environment. So recently, we certainly have heard the president talk about $50 billion that he'd like to have support for to put into infrastructure building. We certainly support that because that could create jobs that just wouldn't impact construction workers or our electrical workers, but it would have an impact on the whole of us, because if we start to build our schools, build schools or build new schools or get that infrastructure, that's going to help with the education of the kids, the environment that they're in, right? A good building that is wired so that they can have the internet, that has an effect. When people go back to work, that means that they become taxpayers again, and this will help with the deficit that we see in so many of our governments locally, be it state, county, or city. So we'll help with the tax base there. When we put Americans back to work, we certainly see that it helps the whole of the community. One of the things, however, we would certainly, and we have been supporting here at the Federation and calling upon our government to do, is we believe strongly that we must support our small businesses. Because they can employ workers, but many small businesses say that they can't get right now the loans that they need to maintain their businesses. So we would like to see some of that leftover TARP money, about $30 billion of it, be invested with small community banks so that the community banks can start to lend again and lend to small businesses who do employ a lot of our workers.
And finally, we're starting to see now the implementation of the health care bill. Tell me your initial thoughts on that, how you think it's going, and maybe some thoughts for the future.
Well, my first thought is, you know, you can't get everything that you want, but for nearly 100 years in this country, we talked about the need for having health care reform and passing it. It was historic, the fact that we were able to get health care reform. We can always continue to try to build upon it, but certainly the foundation that we have is a good foundation. For example, I think this week as we're speaking, we will start to see the ability for us to keep our children, if we have children that are the age of 26 years old, can be on the plane.
Thank you to our guest this week, WUSA 9 reporter and weekend anchor Bruce Johnson, AFGE public policy director Jackie Simon, and AFL CIO executive vice president Arlene Holt Baker. And that's The View from Inside Government.
It's a very good foundation to build upon. We in the labor movement, we know clearly that so often we have not been able to see wage increases for our workers, although production has been up in this country for workers, but because we were bargaining to make sure that our workforce had health care. Unions have bargained to ensure health care, therefore, in some instances, not being able to get the kind of wage increases that were necessary, but we've ensured health care. So this is good. Many of us certainly would have wanted maybe a public option, but you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, and you build on its foundation. So great first step, great historic step, and let's continue to see how we can make it sure that it meets its guarantee that every person in this country, citizen in this country, has access to quality and affordable health care. That's the goal.
We'll certainly be keeping our eye on that in the weeks, months, and years ahead. Arlene Holt Baker, Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO, always a pleasure to see you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University.